Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, taking a break this summer, but we've left you with a special series while we're away. Some favorite interviews with musicians from the Diane Rehm Show archive. Every Friday, we'll post a new one. Today's is a conversation with Linda Ronstadt, recorded in July 2014. She and I had both received Presidential Medals of Honor the previous day, and she graciously agreed to join me in the studio the very next day. I'm so glad she did. Legendary singer Linda Ronstadt has sold more than 100 million records in her 40-year career. She's best known for chart-topping hits like You're No Good, Blue Bayou, and When Will I Be Loved? Ronstadt was the first female artist in popular music history to release 4 consecutive platinum albums. But last year, a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease forced her to stop singing. She's in Washington, D.C. this week, where yesterday she received the National Medal of Arts from President Obama. Linda Ronstadt joins me in the studio to talk about her rise to stardom, her life in music, and living with Parkinson's. And Linda Ronstadt, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so glad to see you.
Well, I'm delighted.
Tell us about that ceremony yesterday and how you felt.
Well, I think most artists always will say, I don't know if you agree with this or not, but I felt like a fraud. You know, I felt surely they'd made a mistake and they would be telling me any minute that, you know, I needed to go home. I was on the wrong list.
I didn't know anybody else in the world felt that way.
I think a lot of people do. I mean, I just think, you know, I guess because art is an ongoing process and you always think you're going to correct the mistakes you made the day before. It's just painful for me to listen to any of my old records. I can't bear it. It'll wreck my week, you know, ruin the month, actually. I'll always think I can't sing. I never was able to sing, and now here's proof.
You know? Oh, my gosh.
So it's like that kind of. But otherwise, I was delighted, and I am a great fan of President Obama and think he has been a fine president. And I'm very pleased that we've had to have someone of his grace and his dignity, which is rare in American culture these days. I was very impressed. I expected to be impressed, and I was very much more impressed.
Good.
With him.
Good. I felt the same way. You published your memoir last year, but it comes out in paperback this September. So why was it the time to write your memoir?
Well, I felt that there'd been enough written about me that I didn't get to have, you know, my say in. And the book is really about the music. I mean, I think that there are a lot of singers out there, and many singers much better than I am. But what I think that I did that was different was that I sang an unusually diverse repertoire. And I wanted to write about how that came about and why those decisions weren't purely arbitrary, that it was really what my background was, how I grew up, you know, with Mexican music blaring at me, you know, from...
You know, I think the thing that surprised me the most was how extraordinarily musical your entire family was.
Well, they all were. I mean, you know, here's what I think. I think everybody's musical. If you're given a chance and it's cultivated early in your life, like from age of 2 or 1, then everybody has a chance to be musical. Everyone is musical. It's an essential part of our biochemistry. It has to be there. It helps us with a job of work. It helps us to identify our feelings. It helps us to express our sorrow or our joy. And it's essential. You know, art is essential. It's not a frill. It's not an extra thing. Carl Polnick, who was the head of the Boston Conservatory, is fond of pointing out that in the concentration camps, there wasn't food. There wasn't anything to sustain a human being, but there was always art. That was the last thing to die in the concentration camps. So that is how essential art is to human existence and human survival.
So in the memoir, you did not write about Parkinson's disease.
I didn't know. Well, when I started the book, I was almost finished with the book when I found out that I might have it. And they said they'd give me a final diagnosis in 9 months. And I said, well, for that 9 months, I'm going to believe I don't have it. You know, it was a little grace period that I just walked around with this idea that I wasn't going to have it. But it turned out not to be true. So
how has it affected your voice?
Well, it affected my voice first, I think. And I think I started having it in about the year 2000. It took away the sheen of all the beautiful kind of resonance that people have in human voices when they sing. There's a whole lot of notes that dance around. There are a lot of sympathetic frequencies, a lot of sympathetic tones that dance around. That was gone. And it's in that area that you do all the kind of mystical steering, that you can dial in emotion or pitch, you know, both the very technical parts of singing and the more spiritual parts of singing, where you bring in emotion, ferocity, and whatever.
Did you feel it, or did others tell you?
No, I could tell, because you're very acutely aware. As you know, you speak, so you're very acutely aware of what goes on with your voice at every minute, every day.
Of course.
And so and in order to speak, or especially in order to sing, there are a huge number of vibrations per second, you know, hundreds, that you have to do with singing, in order to sort of reshape your vocal cords on a very exquisite level to form different planes for the sound to bounce off of. So when you don't have that ability, you're not singing, you're just shouting. So I was shouting for several years on stage.
What did you think was going on with your voice?
I knew it was mechanical. I kept going to the voice doctor and he'd say, you're just neurotic, you're a perfectionist, there's nothing wrong with your vocal cords. Did you have that problem?
Same thing.
They told you it was emotional.
It's all in your head.
Yeah, right. Well, it was all in my throat. It was all in my head, because my brain cells were being destroyed, you know, and they weren't able to send the message neurologically to do all those muscular movements.
Yeah.
So, and I would do my voice exercises. I mean, I really work, you know, I'm a crafts person. I really work at my craft, but I couldn't, no matter what I did, I couldn't make it work.
And once you knew you couldn't make it work, you didn't want to sing anymore.
Well, I couldn't, you know, I'd sing a few notes. Like the first few notes would sometimes come out, and then it would feel like my voice had a cramp in it. It would just stiffen up like a board. It would just get stiff as a board. And there was no moving it, you know. And it is that way to a certain extent with talking. But talking is I can speak. I can make myself speak, because I can stop when I need to. I don't have to hold a note.
Yeah, yeah.
On a consonant or a vowel.
And your grandmother, I gather, had Parkinson's.
Yeah, my maternal grandmother had Parkinson's disease. So I imagine there's a genetic component, and then there's, you know, probably your environment pulls the trigger. I grew up the perfect storm. They say pesticides can affect it. They sprayed my entire neighborhood with trucks with DDT. It was just clouds of DDT. We used to run behind the trucks in the clouds of DDT, because it's like being in fog, you know. And then my father had a box full of mercury because he worked in silver a lot for fun. You know, he had a hobby of working in silver. And we'd find the mercury, and we'd play with it, and we'd hit it with a hammer and shatter it. We thought so it was in the carpeting, you know. I mean, my house was full of mercury. And then I went to Africa, and I got a tick bite. I came back. My health was never the same after that. So apparently there are tick-borne diseases that can set it off.
What about anyone else in your family? Your sister, your brother.
My sister's 7 years older than I am, and she can climb up on the roof and fix the cooler. You know, she's unbelievable. There's a real streak of longevity, and you know, she's biodiverse. She's bionic. I don't know.
Well, you know,
she can still sing too.
She can.
Yeah, everybody in my family can sing, except for me at this point.
And that's what you all did. You all sang together.
We all sang together. Not on a professional level necessarily, but we all sang together. We sang in the car. We weren't ever bored. We sang when we were washing the dishes. It made the job go better. You know, we sang at the dinner table. We weren't allowed to bring a book and read at the dinner table. That was considered rude. But if you wanted to sing, you could sing all you wanted.
Really?
You know, my father would just start singing. We'd just sing harmonies, you know, Spanish, English, didn't matter. We would sing, or he'd sing some opera aria, and we'd all sing.
Did you ever think as a group you might perform professionally?
Well, my sister and my older brother and I had a trio. We called ourselves the New Union Ramblers. That was the 60s. You know, we were trying to be cool. We were trying to be folky. And we sounded nice. We had that sibling harmony. You know, we didn't know very much about what we were doing, but we did our best, and we played little clubs. And then I really wanted to be where it was a big pool of musicians, and a lot of reception for that. I wanted a place where the culture would actually resonate to the kind of music that I loved, and it turned out to be Los Angeles. There were clubs like the Ash Grove and the Troubadour.
We have a posting on Facebook from Cheryl, who says, could you please tell us about the other musicians in your family, i.e. your nephew, Michael?
Well, we call him Mikey. There's Big Mike, who's his dad, who's my younger brother, and who's a traveling musician. And he's in a group called the Ronstadt Generations with Mikey, who's my nephew, and Petey, who's the other brother. And Mikey's a master's-level cellist, and he also plays guitar really well. He can play anything, really, with strings that you pick up. And is really well-versed in various rhythm cultures, like Caribbean rhythm culture. And
so this musical sensibility just goes all the way through this
family. There was always eclectic mania prevailed always in our household. My grandmother and grandfather loved opera and classical music. And my grandfather had been, in the 19th century, was a conductor of a sort of a military band, a kind of an oompah brass band. And he wrote compositions and arrangements for that band, conducted it, taught everyone their instruments. He was like the music man, except he was the real deal. He could really play, you know. And my grandmother loved opera, and she listened to the Saturday afternoon broadcast from the Met every Saturday. We'd go over there and sing along with it. Everybody knew the arias, you know. You knew all the major arias. And played them and sang them on the piano, not to the point where you could go stand on stage at the Met, but so that you could sing it for yourself in your privacy of your sorrow or your joy or whatever you wanted to express. You know, so that went on, and everybody played guitar, ukulele or something, piano.
But tell me about that first album you made.
Well, it was stunning that it didn't turn out nearly the way that I had imagined in my head. And also, you know, we always copy people that want to have art, that you start out by copying somebody and then you're completely surprised to find out you don't sound anything like it, because in trying to copy, you don't get there, but you get to something. And that's where you start. Everybody copies. So I was amazed to find out that I didn't sound like Judy Collins or Joan Baez or whoever I was trying to copy in those days. You know, Mary Travers, maybe. Hank Williams, didn't sound anything like him. So, and I wasn't very knowledgeable about the recording process. I didn't know that much about music, so it was hard for me to control it and make it turn out to be an extension of my musical whim. So I didn't like it very much, you know, and I was disappointed.
Your first hit came with a band called the Stone Ponies.
Right, yeah.
Was that when you knew you had arrived?
Well, we knew something. We didn't have any money, and a car was broken down, and we had to stop at a gas station. We pushed the car into a gas station because it wouldn't work. And the guy told us the car was completely dead. It would, you know, some whore had thrown a rod or something. Whore would never be able to drive again. It was our only car. We had this huge double bass in the back seat, so we're taking that out of the back and standing there in the gas station with, you know, two guitars and a huge double bass. What are we going to do? So, but in the back of the gas station, I could hear the intro of a different drum, and I thought, we have a hit record. We didn't have any money.
You had no money, but you had a hit record. You say it's hard for you to listen to your own music. Why is that?
Well, music is, for us, always a work in progress. Like, I say I don't like to listen to recorded music very much. I'd rather listen to live music. When I record, for me, the music is always live.
Yeah.
So I spend, you know, weeks with live music in the studio. And then it changes imperceptibly as we go along. You know, it's never the same after we've had it on the road for 10 days as it was in the studio.
So are you correcting what you hear in your own mind?
I feel like I'm expanding it emotionally or expanding it in some way musically. You know, I just get better at it, and I know how to do it better.
Even we'll both live a lot longer if you live without me.
Talk about the lyrics here and what they meant to you.
Well, I really like those lyrics. I think that my generation, my sister was 7 years older than I was, and she was the generation where you got married and you wore a panty girdle and you cooked dinner and we were there waiting for the husband when he came home and he...
Now we wear Spanx, right?
Or something. I wear cotton socks and clogs. But, you know, that it was a different... The husband paid for everything. The woman didn't work. It was, you know, she wasn't independent. And in my generation, which was right after World War II, that began to change. And I just never could quite go with the idea of that somebody could tell me what to do. You know, I didn't like it.
Linda, I wonder whether you can remember what it felt like when one of your songs hit the top 10.
Well, this one did. I think it went to number 3, or maybe it was number 1. I can't remember. But again, it's such an ephemeral deal, you know, and I knew that by that time. I knew that if there wasn't another hit really soon, that we were going to be working, we were going to be standing on the side of the road with a broken down car again, you know.
So you got to keep doing it.
And we had to hit the road. That was the main thing. I had to hit the road. So I went out on there. The band sort of disbanded at that point. Kenny Edwards didn't really like the idea of it. He wasn't that crazy about the music we were doing. We didn't know how we could change it. He went to India to study with some Indian guru. And Kenny was always smart, kind of intellectual guy, reader. And Bobby went and started a club called McCabe's, which is still going this day in Los Angeles very successfully. And I went on the road with the Doors.
What about I Can't Help It If I'm Still in Love?
Well, I met Emmy Lou Harris. I met her in Texas, but she was from this area. And I came back. Every time I would come back through this area, we would get together and we would spend all night long, stay up all night playing music. We'd go over to John Starling's house, who lives out in Bethesda, and we'd play bluegrass music. And Ricky Skaggs was a lineman, for one of the counties around here, working as a lineman.
Wow.
And he would come over and sing tenor and teach us everything we needed to know about bluegrass music. So that's how I started singing with Emmy.
Have an email from Richard in Washington who says, I love Linda's collaborations with Emmy Lou Harris and Dolly Parton. How did that come about?
Well, I met Emmy because somebody in the Flying Burrito Brothers told me that she was doing country rock like I was trying to do. And there weren't very many people trying to sing country music, you know, from pop music. He said, you two girls just have to meet. You're really going to like each other. Well, how often does that happen, you know? So I did meet her. She was singing with Graham Parsons. I met her in Texas. And we just loved each other's, what we were chasing, you know? I loved her. I fell in love with her voice. Emmy has a real urgency about the way she sings. It's like, it's so urgent that you listen to her because life or death depends on it.
So here you are, making music, making albums. Tell us about making the album Heart Like a Wheel.
Well, I'd heard this song in a taxi cab called Heart Like a Wheel. Jerry Jeff Walker had sung it to me. It was, you know, just 6 o'clock in the morning as the sun was coming up. And it is, for all practical purposes, I think we could define it as an art song. It is a beautiful, beautiful song. It wasn't quite folk music. It certainly wasn't rock and roll. It wasn't pop music. I didn't know what it was, but I knew I had to sing it. And I knew that was the direction I wanted to go in. So I went back to Los Angeles and I started begging producers and record companies, I want to record this song, Heart Like a Wheel. They go, that's corny. It's not a hit. You know? So I just held on to it. I sort of put it away in my back pocket because I didn't want the song to get its feelings hurt. And then one night we were getting ready to play Carnegie Hall and Andrew Gold was in my band and he'd learned the song for some reason from someplace. And he was playing the intro to it. I said, I love that song. Let's put it in the show tomorrow. So we put it in the show, and we got a tremendous response from the Carnegie Hall crowd.
Feeling better now that we're through.
Did you have somebody in mind
always.
When you sang this?
Always. Every
really?
Song, yeah.
Really?
Always, yeah.
And that sort of helps.
Well, it just becomes who you're talking to, you know?
Yeah. You're talking to someone when you're singing.
Always, yeah. I mean, I have to say, sometimes you sing about disappointment. It might be disappointment that you just went to the market and you were trying to buy, you know, a certain kind of bread from butter pickles and they didn't have them. So you're just, it's ongoing. It's not the same each time. And it could be one person at the beginning of the sentence, somebody else in the middle of the sentence, and somebody else at the end. You know, it's not always the same person. Because you don't always, because the feeling doesn't always fit one person or one situation, but it's always flexible.
More of my conversation with Linda Ronstadt when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Linda Ronstadt, recorded in July 2014. We've got lots of callers waiting. We'll open the phones.
Okay.
Let's go to Richard in Deerfield Beach, Florida. Hi there. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Linda.
Hi.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
So glad to listen to you speaking about your career. I'm a bassist that was in Atlantic City. I was on the Merv Griffin Band. I got to play with Frank Sinatra, Tony Bennett, was with Stephen Eady for years. Pete
oh,
Jackson
fantastic.
Passed away.
So you played
yes.
with good players.
I just wanted to thank you first, Linda, for recording the Great American Songbook. These songs that were so important, you know, in American history, this is one of our great contributions. And to hear you record this music was so inspiring. As someone in pop music and did such a great job with it. You were swinging, because I'm a swinging player.
Well, thank
to
you.
To hear you swing and to do that was just such a joy. my question is how was your experience with recording the Nelson Riddle arrangements? What was your experience like?
I wanted to record standards because I think what the United States gave to the world culture at large was the American popular song. And it's absolutely, you know, the zenith of its development were the American standard songs, because that combination of, you know, people who were brought in chains from Africa, then the Creole culture down in New Orleans, which was very much a European thing, and then the people that migrated here, the Irish and the Italians and the Jews, and then that was the top layer of the sandwich, sort of like a very refined European orchestral meeting this kind of 5-beat West African rhythm culture. And that's what created the American standard song. Without those elements, it's not really that, you know, because rock and roll is a different rhythm culture. It's 2 and 4. But that 5-beat rhythm culture, it's just a different thing. And the lyrics were so beautifully crafted. They were complex lyrics. They'd have an intellectual, highly literate reference with something that's just as basic as I fell in love and got my heart stomped on. And it was all layered on, you know, so you could get it on any level. You know, you could get it on an intellectual level. You could get it on a purely physical, spiritual, mental, any kind of level you wanted.
And Linda Ronstadt, here's an email from Walt, who says, "You did such a great job with mariachi music. Please explore this."
Well, Mexican music was in my ears and in my radio and in my dad's mouth, you know, from the time that I was born. I thought when I was a little girl that people sang in Spanish and they spoke in English. So I just thought Spanish was this sort of musical language somehow. And we learned all the songs kind of phonetically. I didn't always know what they meant until I recorded them professionally. I grew up singing those songs. It was still, they're really difficult things. Again, it's a different rhythm culture. The rhythm culture of the son is indigenous Mexican. It's not West African. It's not European. And it's just harder than heck to try to learn it. And fortunately, since I grew up listening to it, I was able to do it. But it took a lot of wood shedding to get myself up to a professional level so that I could sing the Mexican
stuff.
You
know, I wonder how much serious teaching you had musically, or did you simply absorb it?
I didn't have any formal teaching. I remember I wanted piano lessons so badly, my mom sent me off to this Catholic nun at our Catholic school, you know, and I didn't do something right, and she hit my hand. And my mother was really upset, but instead of finding me another teacher that wouldn't hit me, you know, I never got piano lessons. So I would sort of learn by ear. I would sort of copy what my sister and brother would play in their piano lessons. But with Mexican music, it was simply a question of just listening to records. I listened to Lola Beltran and Amalia Mendoza and the Trio Calaveras and the Trio Tariacuri. Those are my four big sources, you know, of songs that I learned. And I listened to my dad sing. And some of the songs that I recorded, I never heard a recording of. I'd only heard the family sing very old songs.
I see.
And so we just sort of put them together with some kind of an arrangement. I got the mariachi baracas because they had the reputation of being the best in the world, and they were the best in the world next to the mariachi Los Camperos, who are in Los Angeles still. And I played with them until I gave up singing.
Until
I retired, yeah. The Camperos.
What does it feel like to hear from all these people who adore your music, who love listening to you? Is there just this sadness in you that you cannot sing anymore?
Well, the saddest thing is when I run into my nephew Mikey and my nephew Petey, who are quite a bit younger than I am. And they're singing and writing songs now. And they play their songs for me. And I go, I can sing a harmony for that. I can, you know, the harmony just comes into my head. But I can't sing it. And I know that I can blend with them because it's the family voice, you know. And I know that I could sing with them. And I just feel so bad that I got shortchanged out of that whole generation of my family, singing with my family. You know, I sang with cousins, but I didn't get to sing with those nephews.
And the Parkinson's disease has affected your entire body.
Yeah, it has. I mean, it's just like brushing my teeth. It's a weird thing. I didn't know what Parkinson's disease was going to be like because I was very young when my grandmother died. But, you know, when you're trying to brush your teeth, your whole all your muscles clamp up, you know, like they're trying to brush your teeth too, like in your toes and everything. So I'm so tired by the time I get done brushing my teeth, I have to go lie down, you know. So things like, I mean, traveling around and doing shows, or, I mean, even if I could sing, I don't think I'd be able to travel. It's very hard to ride on a plane, or, you know, getting dressed, all those things, anything that requires any kind of fine, like getting my hands through my sleeves is really hard.
Right.
It makes me cuss every day.
Yeah.
And getting in and out of the car, I'm so slow that, you know, if you're trying to hurry for traffic, you're trying to get out of a crowded street, you get run over because I'm so slow.
So you have help with you most of
Yeah,
the
I have to take somebody with me. I mean, I take a wheelchair if it's going to be more than three blocks, or if I think that I'm going to be sitting in an uncomfortable chair, even though a wheelchair is pretty uncomfortable too, but... you know, I just can't sit up in a straight back chair for very long, or although say that I really get it now what it means to be disabled. It means you can't do that. Like yesterday, to not be able to get up and walk across the room and start a conversation, I couldn't do that, you know. So I thought, well, this is what it really means to have a disability. You can't do what you want to do.
So,
By the same token, I'm very grateful for the kind of facilities that, you know, the kind of lobbying that people did where there was legislation for handicap facilities and restrooms, and that's incredibly helpful to me now, and I'm very grateful for it.
Do you ever say to yourself, why me?
Well, I just figure it was a genetic accident. You know, it's just the roll of the dice. And when I think about it, I think, well, I had a really long turn at the trough, and I had a pretty good life, and, you know, now it's time to pay the piper, I guess.
But you're still...
Everybody has something wrong, you know.
You're still enjoying life.
Yeah, I do. And I, you know, I mean, I know it gets much worse. I was with a friend who's a singer just 3 days ago. We had dinner together, and she is wheelchair bound. And
she has Parkinson's.
Yeah, much worse than I do. It's much, she had the operation, so she can sing a little bit.
She had an operation on her vocal cords?
No, she had that deep brain stimulation.
Oh, she had the deep brain stimulation.
But my doctor said I'm not a candidate for that. So
why?
I think it's not advanced enough yet. It's very risky. You could lose your ability to speak altogether, and I don't like to take that risk, you know, and get a blood clot, I guess.
Do you live alone or with a helper?
Well, I have an assistant that comes in 5 days a week, you know, for the day. And probably I'm going to need somebody at night soon. I don't know when, how soon that'll be. My daughter lives in the house in the back, so she's in and out, bless her heart. She helps me with little stuff, you know.
You've never married.
No, I never have.
But you do have.
I had a lot of boyfriends.
You've had a lot of boyfriends.
I had a lot of boyfriends. I didn't want to eliminate too many of them.
Yeah. But you wanted children.
I love children. I really did want children, so I wound up with two children that I adopted. And they're big now, thank God. They grew up to bigness. So most of them, you know, they're pretty much responsible for themselves now, but I look over them carefully.
But you wanted to raise them on your own.
Well, it just seemed like the chance of disagreeing about how they should be raised would, you know, just, as soon as my children were born, it just didn't seem like there was room for somebody else's opinion. It just didn't, you know. I mean, it's great if the other person's opinion is always supportive and wonderful and you're in agreement, but that doesn't always happen. And I never had a date after my daughter was born.
Really?
That was just the end of that part of my life. I don't know why. I just thought, you know, I got enough going on here with taking care of this person, trying to keep her alive.
And trying to take care of them as a single mother and as a performer had to be tough.
Well, I quit working a lot. I mean, when they were little, I really just didn't work. I stayed home, especially during the school year. I drove them to school. I used to listen to your show, driving them to school and back in the morning.
It was
my mainstay, so I thank you for that. But, you know, I was there in their lives. And then in the summertime when I did tour a little bit, they went with me on the bus. And they loved the bus because we didn't have any television and we didn't have any computers. And they get on the bus and there'd be all these TV and computers. And they go, we love this.
Oh.
We stand on the bus, you know, and I go, oh, my God, my children are being corrupted.
Did they sing?
Oh, they can both sing. And my son's a good guitar player, but neither of them have any ideas about being professional, for which I'm thankful. It's a very difficult life.
How so?
Well, there's no regularity. What is it? Flaubert said, be regular and orderly in your everyday life, like a bourgeois, so that you can be violent and original in your art. I love that. I've tried to live by that, you know.
Fantastic
quotation. I love Flaubert. He's good. Yeah. But, you know, it's hard to it's hard to have a regular life. It's hard to keep from getting very defensive. You know, it's hard to keep yourself to be an open person because everybody's jumping on you and everybody wants something. And often somebody's disappointing. You know, there's something disappointing. You feel rejected. You feel like your music isn't good enough. All those things you have to go through, they're very disconcerting, you know.
I want to get back to that question of the changes in your life because there are a great many people who find themselves, as they get older, affected in one way or another, and who, as a result, begin withdrawing from life.
I feel that way myself. I really do. I'm pretty happy to sit in the corner and just listen now. I'm always interested in what's going on. I like to learn. I was always a reader, and I like learning. I gave myself my own education. I didn't go to college.
Nor did I.
Yeah, okay, good. We'll form a club. We'll form a sorority.
Absolutely.
But I'm always interested in finding out what's going on. And I would always get in and ask questions, and that's how I would learn. But I find now that I just kind of sit, and I'm way more passive in a conversation. Maybe that can be changed. I don't know. I think it's an impulse I have to fight. You know, I make sure that I get out a couple of times a week with people, even though I really would rather just stay home and lie down, because when I'm lying down, that's the only time I really know where I am in space. You know, I'm not craning off the walls.
Reading.
I'm a reader, and I read all the time. You know, now I don't remember as much as I used to be able to remember everything.
You know, there are so many of your songs that are in my heart, and this one in particular, When Will I Be Loved?
Treated, been mistreated. When will I be loved? I've been pushed down. I've been pushed round. When will I be loved?
Actually written by
Phil Everly, whom we lost recently, yeah. Wonderful singer, wonderful writer. I mean, one of the great harmony singers of ever in the world. You know, that was a great harmony group, the Everly Brothers. They could do that thing that siblings could do that only siblings can do, you know.
Only siblings.
Yeah, you have to grow up pronouncing the language that way, you know, with the same kind of accent, with the same kind of regional accent. And then the genes just give you sympathetic resonance in your vocal cords that, you know, that sound alike and tune into each other in a certain kind of way. You can only get that from siblings.
And you have felt that.
Well, we just tried to copy them as much as we could when we were kids growing up.
You tried to copy the Everly Brothers.
Of course. You know, they were on the radio during the 50s. They were so fabulous.
They were fabulous. But this, too, is fabulous.
It was Kenny Edwards and Andrew Gold singing with me. They're both gone, both of them. I toured with them for years and years. Kenny was in the Stone Ponies, and he came back and played with me and my band for years after that.
Somebody asked whether you're still in touch with the Stone Ponies.
Well, Kenny, you know, like I said, is gone. I still see Bobby Kimmel. He's moved back to Tucson just about the time that I moved back to San Francisco from Tucson. But I see him when I go there, and we're in regular contact. We talk all the time. He's in a band, actually, a vocal band, with my cousin's wife, who used to be married, who used to date Jimmy Webb, who also writes a bunch of my songs. He wrote a song called "Where's the Playground, Susie" that I tried to record in the late '60s, about her, and then she later married my cousin Johnny Ronstadt, so she's now Susie Ronstadt. But anyway, it's funny how everybody that you know knows everybody else that you know.
Why about 300 San people in the Francisco world. Now?
Well, the politics were getting so gnarly in Arizona. I grew up in Arizona. I love it. I'm a part of the desert. I feel like really I'm from the Sonoran Desert, which extends to both sides of the border. I'm really from that part of Mexico also. And I hate that there's a fence between, you know, running through it. And I think it should come down as fast as it can, just like the Berlin Wall. We have to take the damn thing down. But you know that fence howls and moans at night when the wind blows? People say it's howling for the people that died because of the fence going up. But, yeah, I still see him. Still see Bobby Kimmel.
And I'm so glad to have seen you.
Me too.
Thank you, Linda.
Thank you so much.
That was legendary singer Linda Ronstadt. She joined me on the Diane Reams Show on July 29th, 2014. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Bent Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.